Our next guest is Peter Ireland of AntiVentureCapital.com. Peter, will you tell us a little bit about your background and the services that you offer to entrepreneurs?
Okay. Well, I've been an entrepreneur ever since college. I ran some businesses during college to pay my way through, and I had a commitment to becoming an entrepreneur as soon as I graduated. This was back in the mid-80s. So I was always interested in a specific topic, which is how you get a business launched if you don't have access to a lot of money, because accessing outside capital is not something that most people can do, especially on their on their first venture, because they lack a track record. And investors like to back entrepreneurs who have a proven track record, a demonstrable track record of having built a successful company, having made money for the previous investors and fund. So that became a key area of focus for me. And I just started collecting solutions or stories about how other entrepreneurs had solved this problem, as far back as probably the early 1980s, because I knew that I would have to deal with that challenge once I was out of college. So I just started collecting stories about how people had overcome this particular problem, and collected quite a few of them over about 10 years or so, and then I was always telling other people how they could use some of these different strategies and tactics to get their companies off the ground with minimal capital. And then at some point, I don't know, back around 93 or so, somebody said, you should write a book. You've collected so many of these. Why not write a book? So I started writing a book, and then I put this website up in late 95 or early 96, I can't remember anymore, that sold the financing manual. And it was about maybe 50 pages long at that time. Now it's about 220 pages in length. So I've added quite a bit of additional information to it over the years. But basically, most people don't understand how companies are financed, and what they do is they waste a lot of time, on average from 6 to 12 months, attempting to find some kind stranger to write them a big check so that they can start off, with an instant salary and a nice office and all that, and that's simply not the way the world works. One thing that I try to teach people is the fact that, you shouldn't be thinking about how to finance the company. You should be thinking about how to finance the individual assets that you'll need. And if you break it down into assets and you go, well, okay, I'm going to need these three or four different assets. I'm going to need a delivery vehicle. I'm going to need some computer equipment, and I'm going to need a machine to make my widgets. Then that opens up a whole world of possibilities, because there are all sorts of different ways that you can finance each of those individual assets, whether it's through leasing or just borrowing the equipment when it's not being used. I mean, they're all just all sorts of solutions. So that in a nutshell, kind of a long answer to your original question there, but that's what's been my primary interest. If you don't have a lot of access to capital, How do you get around this problem of starting up a company? So, what is your next question?
What do you think is the best definition for venture capital?
It's going to be a little bit difficult for me to come up with a one or two line definition. Basically, think of it this way: if you've got a company that has huge potential to make it really, become the next Facebook, Google, Microsoft, or whatever, it's like a baton in a relay race. We've got four members on the team, and you know, each one carries that baton by themselves before they pass it on to the next person. So the financing baton has the first player is you, the founder. You've got a way, you have to find ways to scrape together the funding to get the thing up and running. Then if you can create some cash flow that'll impress potential investors, the next team member in the relay race to pick up the baton from you would consist of angel investors or private investors. And then they help you to build that company up a little bit more. Then the baton is passed on to the third player in the relay race, so to speak, and that's the venture capital segment. And these guys are usually interested only in companies that have a proven track record. The company's been around for a couple of years at least and has real sales, you know, bona fide sales to bona fide customers. You know, the demand is growing, and they see that the company has huge potential, you know, that it's going to be hitting revenues in the billions of dollars. And then, so, you know, build it up more, and then they finally pass it to the fourth and last player in a great relay race of, you know, building a company up, and that is, you know, the investment banks that would take that company public, you know, on the NASDAQ or Toronto Stock Exchange or London Stock Exchange, wherever the company happens to be located. So, you know, to try to answer your question as best as I can, you've got these four different levels of financing sources, and the venture capital segment is the third one in that baton race. And, you know, they invest other people's money in companies, and they manage the portfolio. So hopefully that's giving you a decent picture of who they are, where they're positioned in the business.
Yeah, that's very helpful. I feel like, as you say on your website, a lot of entrepreneurs think, you know, right off the bat, I need venture capital, but that's probably a bad choice for their business.
Well, yeah, they're not going to get it. I mean, they're really wasting their time. And to be honest with you, when anybody with a bit of experience hears a total rookie saying, I'm going for venture capital, you know, sort of tend to roll their eyes. Maybe they'll turn away so that the person can't see them rolling their eyes. But, you know, they're thinking, well, this person really doesn't understand the game. See, entrepreneurship differs from getting a job, and that entrepreneurship is all about being tested by the world, by the business world. It's about meeting those tests and passing them. And the tests never really end. And so, you know, that's why I used the analogy of a baton race, you know, a relay race, because before, you know, the baton can get passed on to that second runner, it has to pass some certain tests. And those tests, as I explained, were, you know, it has to have cash flow, and it has to look like it has potential to grow a lot further, and so on. So entrepreneurship is all about passing tests and being able to then say to people, the reason you should invest is because look at what I've done with the company so far. You know, I started off with just an idea. I created a product, I created a company around it, I recruited a team. Now we have sales, the sales are growing. Look at our bank statements, you know, look at our invoices and so on. You know, here's actual documentation showing that this is a for real company. And then, you know, then the first investors step in, who are the angel investors, as I explained a moment ago. Then they help you take the company further. And if you can pass the additional tests required for that additional growth, then the company gets passed on to the venture capitalists and so on. So it's really helpful to understand that entrepreneurship is about being tested continuously. The tests don't just come at the beginning. I mean, you know, they're there every day. And it takes a certain type of personality to be a successful entrepreneur, it's different from somebody who, you know, just wants a job where they can, you know, go in, work for 8 hours, and then go home and not have any worries about meeting the payroll and whether the company's going to hit break even and whether, you know, the necessary capital can be created or attracted or whatever. So, you know, it's all about tests, and the people with the big money, they want to see that you have a track record of passing a whole bunch of these tests, you know, overcoming obstacles in one way or another, whether it's blowing through them, going around them, climbing over them, digging under them, and so on. That's what they want to see. And the only way you can really prove that you pass those tests is by showing that, you know, you do have a company that's grown from zero sales to, you know, millions of dollars or whatever over a period of a few years.
Wow, that's really interesting. So here's another question. With this system that you described as a relay race with forerunners, do you think that this is the best system for entrepreneurs, or do you think that it could be improved?
Well, you know, people are always looking for ways to improve everything. You know, that's capitalism and free markets for you. So the system is slowly changing. I don't know if you've heard of crowdfunding. Have you?
Would that be like websites like Kickstarter, for example?
Yeah. So, you know, now that whole area is kind of dodgy because we don't know how the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, is going to rule on crowdfunding. So it's a little bit dicey, but I have a feeling that they're going to approve it in some way or another so that entrepreneurs then can access capital more readily. So crowdfunding, in a way, can be thought of as a early stage source of financing. It would be part of that first phase in that four-person relay race. Because with crowdfunding, you typically have a lot of investors who aren't gambling a lot. Maybe they're contributing $50 to your company or $100 or something. So they do it almost for fun. It's you know, they if it doesn't go anywhere, it's no big deal. It's not like they've lost $25,000 from their life savings or whatever. So that's gonna open up the whole financing area dramatically. And I'm all for it. I mean, I'd like to see crowdfunding be made, you know, fully kosher in terms of securities laws so that people can invest. They can't take a gamble on businesses that they like, but with an upper limit as to how much, you know, they can invest in a particular company, you know, maybe $100 or $500 maximum. And, you know, and then they would be made to understand that, you know, there is a possibility that they'll lose it, but it's not going to kill you, you know, if you've lost $500 or $100. So anyways, you know, I think that's going to be altering the system. You know, for a long time, the venture capital community has sort of controlled everything. And by control, what I mean is, you know, the people in the second phase of the relay race, the angel investors, they would only invest in companies that they thought they could then flip to the venture capitalists, you know, a year or two later. So everything was sort of determined by whether or not people thought the venture capital firms would be interested in a deal. So they had a tremendous amount of influence in what got funded and what didn't get funded. If something didn't look like it would appeal to venture capitalists, then nobody wanted to touch it, even if they thought it was a good business otherwise. So, you know, again, to answer your question about is the system changing, is the system the best one that it could be? No, it's not, and it is changing, and the whole crowdfunding concept is pushing a huge change, and the venture capital firms are actually starting to lose a lot of their influence, a lot of their control, because you know you can have companies that go very far that are just funded by a bunch of individuals who each put in $500 or $200 or whatever, and so that's how things are changing, and they're hopefully changing for the better. The venture capitalists, they're losing their control over the whole funding chain.
It sounds like the crowdsourcing idea would probably be a lot better for everyone, especially because you're not giving up nearly as much control. As I've seen on these websites, oftentimes the incentive is, say, like an upgraded version of the product rather than a stake in the company.
Yeah, you got different models in crowdfunding. With some you give up equity in the company. With some, the money comes in as a form of a loan, which has to be repaid. With some sites, the company pays back its investors with product instead of financially and all that. So we've got all these great little living laboratories or petri dishes, if you prefer, where people are experimenting to figure out what works best. And I'm sure that over time we'll decide that all of these different ways work, and that we should have different sites offering different ways for people to put money into a company, whether it's through debt, equity, or whatever. So yeah, it's an exciting time.
That's awesome. So what about this? You said on your website that there are a lot of myths about venture capital. What are some real-world facts that entrepreneurs need to know before they even try to find venture capital funding?
Well, I went over the relay race analogy for funding. You can't leapfrog those things. I mean, you have to normally, raise the money yourself first as the entrepreneur, then a year or two later, the angel investors come in to give you some more money to grow the company a little bit more, with the object of flipping it to venture capital. So, one myth there, if we want to call it that, is that you can somehow leapfrog those steps and go straight to venture capital, and you can't. I mean, you just end up wasting a lot of time and money. But the only people that can leapfrog that are people like, Mark Andreessen, or somebody who's had spectacular success in the past. He was involved with the creation of Netscape, which probably before your time, Netscape was like the first really, widely used browser. It came out, I think, in 95 or 96. It was huge news. And since then, Mark Andreessen's done all sorts of things. Ning.com, I think, is one of his ventures. I mean, he's always doing things like that. He's a heavy hitter. I mean, he can, as soon as he gets an idea, he can just pick up the phone and call up any venture capital firm in Silicon Valley and say, listen, I need $5 million to get this idea off the ground. And they're going to give him money. But, for the vast majority of us, the 99.999% of the population, that's just not possible. So that's probably, the biggest myth out there that I can think of. And it's a real problem because so many people just have unrealistic expectations. And as a result, they waste a lot of time, writing business plans, sending them off to venture capital firms. And venture capital firms aren't really interested. They invest based on reputation. They want to know that you're somebody who's made big money before. They also prefer that they know you personally, that you're a technology industry insider. Maybe there's somebody that they've known for a few years. So, because money is invested basically on personal relationships. You're not going to give money to a complete stranger who contacts you over the internet, somebody you've never heard of, because it's easy to falsify information and exaggerate and so on. So it's all done, you know, based on who knows who, how well they know you, are they comfortable with you, your reputation, you know, even personal chemistry comes into it. Do they feel that you're somebody that they can work with, you know, based on their experiences with you in the past and so on. So, you know, the other myth there is that you can just, you know, push a copy of your business plan over the transom or attach it to an email and send it in, and the venture capitalists will take you seriously. That won't. I mean, it's just going to get tossed into the trash immediately.
Right. Yeah, I can definitely understand that being good on good terms, them actually knowing you as a person is probably a lot more important than any financial projections that you have.
Well, that's a good point. That's a really, really good point. Okay, you know, in the past, I've written lots of business plans. When I was in college, I thought, you know, the business plan is one of the most important tools that you can have if you're looking at starting up a company and all that. And I quickly, you know, came to the conclusion that, you know, the projections in a business plan, I mean, they're just numbers that you pull out of the air. And most entrepreneurs will just fabricate those numbers, pull them out of the air, you know, based on a best case scenario. You know, they'll put on their rose-colored glasses and come up with the most optimistic projections. And then they'll do this mind trick, which is they'll start to believe their own figures. And if anybody questions those figures, disputes them and so on, they'll get quite irate. It's like, what do you mean we're not going to hit, you know, $5 million in sales by the end of, you know, month 15? How dare you question this? And they've completely forgotten that they just pulled those numbers out of the air. So, you know, was it old Field Marshal when Clausewitz has a famous saying, you know, no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. And, you know, that applies to business plans. I mean, as soon as you get out there into the marketplace and you start selling your widget, your service, whatever it is, you start to realize that most of your assumptions in the business plan are incorrect, and you have to make you know, course corrections very quickly. You have to learn how to monitor all the market feedback and make changes very quickly to what you're doing in response to market conditions, market feedback, customer feedback, etc. And the really good entrepreneurs are the ones that are alert to any feedback from the marketplace and who are willing to make changes, you know, course corrections quickly, you know, the ones who can turn on a dime, as opposed to the ones who say, well, you know, things aren't going as well as we had predicted in the business plan, but we're just going to stick to the business plan no matter what. Often those entrepreneurs end up, you know, going under after a few months, and whereas the ones who are adaptive, alert to signals, they're the ones that survive over the long haul when, you know, end up, you know, succeeding and prospering, etc.
Definitely. Those sound like some really helpful strategies. You say on your website that savvy entrepreneurs know how to create cash, and wannabes just wait for someone to give them cash. What do you think are some of the best strategies that an entrepreneur can implement to actually create cash early on during that stage when they're funding their own business?
Well, okay, let me give you the opposite answer. Suppose you've come up with a new product idea, and the best place to manufacture it is, say, in China. Okay, let's look at the financing there. Well, you know, you spend a few months finding a Chinese manufacturing company that can produce the product. They give you a firm price on what it will cost per unit to produce and all that. Then they say, well, okay, the minimum order we can accept from you is a 40-foot container load. And a 40-foot container load of your widgets will cost, I don't know, $200,000, right? So now, and they want, like, at least half the money up front. So, and then you say, well, okay, if I give you the $100,000 up front, which is 50%, and then the other 50% when the stuff arrives in Los Angeles or Seattle or Vancouver, how long will it take you to actually deliver the product? And they'll say, well, you know, it'll take us like a month to gear up all the tooling and all that. Then it'll take us another month to actually produce it. Then it'll take another month for it to get to you, right? So we're talking 90 days. So you have to have like $100,000 in capital tied up for 90 days. You know, you don't have access to that capital because they're holding it, you know, through a letter of credit or whatever. This is a nightmare. So to answer your question, then, you want to do the exact opposite of that, where you get paid up front for you know, your product or your service or whatever. And, you know, so it can be beneficial to have something that's sold retail to people, you know, through a website. Although that has complications in itself because you have to have the traffic coming to you in the first place if we can expect anything. But, I mean, that's one way. Another way is to go after business customers. And, again, you know, with products, it's easy to convince customers to pay up front because everybody's used to paying up front for product. You know, I bought a Kindle a few months ago and went to Best Buy. You know, of course, he told me, well, if you want to walk out of the store with your Kindle, you have to pay us $139 or whatever it was. So I paid them, and then I walked out with the product. With services, the really, you know, smart entrepreneurs, they know how to repackage a service as a product so that they get paid up front, say at least 50%, if not 100%. You know, so this is kind of a complicated area, but you know, if you're selling some ongoing service where normally the customer would pay like a monthly fee, you know, you can come up with different ways of sort of a new way to describe the service to make it sound more like a product. Then you come up with a name for that product. Well, you know, this is our premium hosting service. And you get all these additional features built into it. And it costs, you know, $150 up front, like that for the year. And then, you know, you don't have to pay anything again for another year. Instead of just, you know, getting them to pay $15 a month per year, I mean, per month, I should say. So you know, there are all sorts of different ways of squeezing money out of customers up front so that you can then use that money to go and actually get the product made or the service delivered. You know, there's an old trick used in the software industry. It's called the vaporware trick. Basically, companies that thought that they could produce a new software product would test the market for it first before they spent any time developing the software. But place, you know, running ads in industry magazines for this bit of, you know, what's called vaporware. They would describe the product and say, well, you know, it has these features, it'll solve these problems for you, contact us if you're interested. And then they'd see how many inquiries they got about the product. And if they got a certain number of inquiries, they'd go, well, you know, it looks like it would be worth our while to actually develop this software. If there weren't a sufficient number of inquiries, you know, response to the ad, then they would decide, well, there's not enough interest in this thing, so, you know, it's a good thing we never bothered actually writing the software. And in cases where there was sufficient interest, they would usually go back to those people and say, well, you know, it's not quite ready, it'll be ready in a month's time, but, you know, if you'd like to get a discount on it when it's available, you know, you should pay 50% up front at this point in time. And then they get money up front, and then they'd, like, go back and you know, pull all-nighters developing the software so that they could deliver it, you know, within the 30 days that they had promised or so. So, you know, in a nutshell, it's a really complicated area. I spent, like, about, you know, 220 pages going over this, but it's all the savvy entrepreneur creates cash by primarily by getting customers to put down deposits to cover the work. And, you know, this is typically found, like, in the contracting industry. You know, if you know any contractors that build houses, that do renovations and so on, you know, they'll quote an estimate to rebuild your kitchen, you know, say $10,000, and then they'll say, and you have to put down 50% up front, because I'm going to use that to, you know, go to Home Depot and buy all the, you know, all the stuff that I'm going to need, the kitchen counters and the new sink and all that, to, you know, the floor tiles and all that. If somebody refuses to put down a 50%, well, the contractor isn't going to bother with them. You know, they just got to go on and find another customer. I mean, that's a legitimate way of doing business. And, you know, the savvy entrepreneurs, they use that same tactic no matter what business they're in, whether they're developing software or, you know, selling widgets or whatever it happens to be. I mean, it's not possible in all cases, but it's certainly possible in a lot of cases to use that tactic to get it up front. So that's one of the key ways of, you know, creating cash flow when the investors are willing to pull out their checkbooks and they can, you know, back your company.
That makes a lot of sense. So what you're saying is that the more money you can get earlier on, and the best, if you can rebrand your product so that you can sell it as a product, like as a premium product.
Yeah, rebrand the service as a product, yeah.
Right, okay. If you can, so the more money you can get up front, and the better you can rebrand your services as products and get them to prepay in advance, the less likely you're going to need investment early on.
Exactly. And it might even turn out that you never need any investors as well. So if you can do it this way, and if you're patient, you know, usually growing this way on internally generated cash flow is a bit slower initially. You know, takes longer. But you know, if independence and autonomy are your you know, priorities in life, it could be well worth it. You know, as soon as you bring in an investor, you basically become an employee. Because suddenly, you know, you're accountable to them. You have to report to them, and usually the paperwork, you know, the investor paperwork will specify that if the investors don't feel that you're doing a good job, they have the right to fire you and replace you with somebody else. So, you know, a lot of people don't feel comfortable with that. So they'd rather grow the company a little bit more slowly, but, you know, be able to retain full control over it. Yeah, I tend to be like that. I prefer not to have to work with investors. I have worked with investors in the past, and it can be a real nuisance, especially, you know, if they aren't in a position to, you know, hold a hammer over your head, you know. The paperwork states that they can fire you at any time and all that, and kick you out of your own company. So, you know, there are a lot of us out there, entrepreneurs, who just prefer to build things at our own rate, have full control, have none of the headaches that come with having outside money.
Right. I can definitely see how that would be a big help, you know, help you be able to retain control, not have to worry about being fired. That would be really good.
Yeah.
Okay, we are almost finished. Let's see. We have two more questions. Second to last one. Your website has a ton of helpful free articles, which go into a lot more detail on many of the topics that we've talked about, and you also have several ebooks, including the Smart Startup Guide. Why should the entrepreneurs listening to this program consider buying your products?
I believe it's a real education in learning how, you know, the really good entrepreneurs startup companies, and you know, a lot of the research work that I talked about when we first started this interview was conducted with what are called Inc. 500 entrepreneurs, and Inc. magazine is, I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a magazine for entrepreneurs. It's the best entrepreneurial magazine out there, and it's been around for decades and decades. And every year they publish this list of the 500 fastest growing, you know, private companies in the United States. So a lot of the information that I gathered, you know, starting back in the 80s, was from calling these entrepreneurs up and saying, "Hey, listen, I found you on the list of being 500. You know, could I talk to you for a few minutes about, you know, the financing techniques that you used and so on to get this thing off the ground?" So these are elite entrepreneurs that I've gotten this information from, and you know, so it's a popular product. You know, it's been selling since about late 95, early 96. I can't remember whether it was December or January. It can save you a lot of time if you're serious about entrepreneurship. You know, show you what works, what doesn't work, and time is of the essence. You know, you don't want to waste 6 months learning something the hard way when you can learn it, you know, from reading a few pages in a book or a manual.
Awesome. Well, remember, you can purchase any of these products at Mr. Island's website, antiventurecapital.com. And Peter, what is the last word of advice that you would like to leave us with?
Well, entrepreneurship is not for everybody, but, you know, if it's a calling. And if you really feel the calling, I would go out there and I would try it. And, you know, this is the key here, find a problem to solve, whether it's a problem that individuals have or if it's the problem that businesses have. That's the way it's done. You know, there's that piece of advice that's been floating around since forever, which is do what you love, the money will follow. That's not really true, because a lot of people love things that nobody else is willing to pay for. You know, as a fellow that I know says, you know, he loves to lie in the hammock and, you know, watch sports all day on television, but nobody's willing to pay for that. So what you need to do is just be alert for problems. Hey, you know, sometimes the way to recognize a problem is because you personally experience it. And then you look around, you ask yourself, well, what if your people experience the same problem? You know, do they have the same frustrations and so on in this area? And if the answer is yes, chances are you've got an opportunity to go after. And, you know, and the more people or the more companies that experience that problem, have that frustration, the better your chances will be if you decide to, you know, put together an entrepreneurial solution for it. So I guess, you know, that's the final and best piece of advice that I can give you, is always look at it from the perspective of the marketplace. You know, what problem are faced by companies or individuals that you could go in and create a solution for.
Wise words indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Ireland, thank you so much for being on the show.
Great. All right. Well, you have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.